I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to another episode of The Gary Hour. I'm your host, Gary Levitt. This is an inspiring episode because I talk to the poet Azim. From crime to creativity, we're going to hear his story of moving around a lot as a kid, getting involved in all kinds of mischief and crime, and what set his life in a different path and led him to become the writer, hip-hop artist, award-winning slam poet, and traveling the world with his art. This episode is brought to you by Future Moments, makers of mobile apps for content creation. If you're a filmmaker, musician, podcaster, go to the App Store and check out Future Moments because they have an app that will make your life easier. Okay, as always, check out the show notes for links to the guests and links to more stuff. Okay, enjoy this episode. Hope you do. I know I did. All right, we got Azim. Thanks for coming by.
Ah, my pleasure.
Voted best rapper of the Bay Area in 2004. You've got 6 hip-hop albums. Second best spoken word slam poetry.
Second best in the nation at one time back in the day when I went under the alias The Invisible Man.
Oh, but now you're visible.
Now I'm a little bit more visible. Yeah, I got a couple pictures on the internet.
You also have a memoir that is pretty fascinating. You got some wild stories in there, going to India and ending up in all kinds of sticky situations.
Yep. It's called The Misfit King. Mm-hmm. And it's my life story, basically, up to a certain point, you know, up to moving to the Bay Area, getting involved in music and beginning my career. Basically, it begins with me traveling through India under what you might call less than respectable circumstances, and it ends in the same trip in India. So the book has 2 bookends on it of India.
What are these less than respectable circumstances?
I was able to travel through India as a... Well, I was the owner of a.
Has 7 years passed? Are you free from all crimes?
Well, yeah, I'm pretty. I don't think anybody from there is going to come after me. But I won't. I will not say the name of the travel agency. But I was the owner of a travel agency in San Francisco who dealt with high end clients, and what we did was we sent our clients to the Maldives Islands for 2 weeks. However, the Maldives being as beautiful and timeless as it is, our clients were getting bored there. So we wanted to send them for a week-long Indian safari where they would get to travel through India and see all the different sites. And we wanted an itinerary that was mapped out and busy and made for them. And that was the story that I was traveling through India on, and a particular
which is not completely true.
No, not at all. I was struggling to. I was probably on like my second album as an underground hip hop artist, and I was far from working with clients in the corporate realm. But it was a great trip, and it was just right place, right time. I was connected with a family who had those type of connections. We made fake business cards. They made all the arrangements. I got to India. There was a guy standing there, you know, in a like he looked like a ship's captain, and he was holding a sign with my name on it. And we got into some Bentley looking car, and they drove me to the Nasandra Palace, and from there, I went to I went to Agra to see the Taj Mahal, and I had my own scholar, and we were going into places in the Taj Mahal that, you know, no other people could go, and he's showing me and giving me the history and reading the walls. And then I took another train and I went to Rishikesh.
But why did you tell this story about being with a travel agency?
That was how I was able to go through it, because this other travel agency basically wanted our high-end clients. They said, oh, you have these high-end clients from the U.S., you know, let's team up and you can send all of your clients to us so we can make money too. And this is an example of the trip we will give them.
Ah.
So I got a trip
nice little
through India of a lifetime. But it was very scary, and the people constantly wanted to meet with me and talk business, and I constantly had to come up with excuses why I couldn't meet them, and there were some times that I felt that I might not come back.
You felt like they would hold you hostage or something?
I didn't know what was going to happen once they kind of... I felt any moment somebody's going to show up in my hotel room and demand some explanations or some money, and neither of which I had.
Right.
I was broke at the time. I went to India broke.
And you got put up in hotels
in
and
everything. All I had to do was pay for food.
And how did you?
You can imagine how inexpensive
it is. It's really inexpensive.
Yeah.
How did you figure out how to do this scam? Like,
I was connected with a family who had a son who knew the politics of the region, and he was, you know, young and kind of a jokester, and kind of just got off on the idea of setting me up in that way.
Yeah.
You know, and I got some great pictures, you know, from the memory. I learned a lot, and shout out to India and all the Indian people out there. I really had a great time, and Indian food and Thai food are some of my favorite foods. So
were there any did you ever experience any serious cultural shock?
I mean, not in that part of the world. No, I've been all over that region. You know, I've been all over Southeast Asia, and I've traveled a lot just based on my career and experiences like that.
But, you traveled a lot as a hip hop artist?
As a hip hop artist, yeah, and a poet. I've never, you know, so I've been, you know, I've been to Tunisia and Algeria, and I've been to Malaysia and Singapore and the Maldives and Sri Lanka and a whole lot of places in that area. I'd never experienced culture shock there. culture shock.
I mean, or a lack of cultural acceptance. I mean, you're a brown skin.
Well, I grew up experiencing lack of culture. Let's call it racism. It was racism's kind of what made me what I was, what I am, because to be honest with you, like, yeah, I'm a brown skinned person, whatever, AKA black person, you know, or whatever that means in society today.
And Azim is your last name.
Azim Il is my last name. Il is a Moorish surname.
Mm-hmm. Which is what, for people listening, what is a Moor?
A Moor is basically a Moor would be the proper status or the proper nationality or term that in an ideal world, so-called black people or who used to be Negroes, who used to be Afro-Americans or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Now African-Americans.
Where are the Moors from? Africa?
Well, the Moors were a worldwide empire. They had a worldwide empire. For example, if you look back in history, the reason why so many of the English terms of science and mathematics mm-hmm. are Arabic mm-hmm. because of the Moors bringing these things to science, like algebra is Arabic, alchemy, chemistry. These are all Arabic words. Oh. Alcohol.
Uh-huh.
So the Moors were the ones who introduced these things. So similar to the way we use Roman script mm-hmm. and things like that,
yeah.
but we're not Romans.
Right.
The Moors had Arabic, but they weren't Arabs right. necessarily, you know. So you can go back in history and look at it that way. But as you look back in history, you see references to Moors or later Blackamoors. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to get these Blackamoors out of Europe. So Moors is the last term that so-called black people were known as before they were termed Negroes or before. See, like when they go to Iraq, they don't say Iraqi fighters; they say insurgents.
Uh-huh.
They have to take the humanity off of them in order to make it seem okay.
Right. It's like you know, you say casualties of war.
Casualties of war, whatever. Yeah. They have another word for them. Collateral damage.
Right.
It's not humans. It's collateral damage.
It's not death.
So you have to dehumanize it. So that's, you know, these terms like African American, that sounds great. I'd love to go to Africa, America, but it doesn't exist. Sounds like the music is great and everything. Right. I'd love to go there.
Yeah.
I bet you weed is legal there too.
Great,
you know?
Climate.
Yeah, great climate, right. But, you know, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So, you know, and when you start, and all of this is fine. None of this really matters when you're talking about everyday life. You know, a lot of people can get by and aren't really caught up in this, even though it seems to be in the media and everybody seems to be being triggered purposely every day for whatever reason. You know, the problem with all of this is when you start looking at the law and the justice system, because when you start dealing with legalese, mm-hmm. all right, what words really mean in the courtroom are different than how we use them.
Right.
The definitions become different. So when you're dealing with legal status and you're dealing with these terms, white, black, Negro, African American, they mean different things when it comes to legal status, like really, 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 you know? Uh-huh. And so you could end up having a lot less rights claiming to be a proud ex-slave. Mm. Hey, I'm a proud ex-slave, which is basically what you're saying. You know, I come from slaves. Well, then we don't really owe you anything because it used to be our property, and we don't owe our property anything.
Uh-huh.
But if you can tie yourself to a landmass, to a culture, to a history, then you have more standing.
Right.
Just as someone with a nationality.
More status.
You have more status.
Yeah.
You know? But not to get too far into that, because at the end of the day, I am an artist.
Right. You know? And the beginning of the day.
But the beginning of the day, yeah.
What is your origin? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Jersey originally, mm-hmm. But I moved from New Jersey to Atlanta, from Atlanta to Los Angeles, from Los Angeles to Miami, and from Miami to the Bay Area. That's when I turned 18.
Oh, wow. How come?
All of that was high school.
So how come? Were you with your family?
I was with my family, yeah. We just moved from all of those reasons were for, you know, they all made sense. One of the times that we moved was from, we moved from Los Angeles to Miami, it was based on a really big mistake that I personally made that is probably the biggest mistake in my life. And I don't really know if it's a bit much. I don't want the audience to think that. I want to say this before I go into anything else. I was raised in a very, like, my parents are Jamaican, right?
Uh-huh.
They came from more of a higher class, you know, in the islands, you have class structure and everything like that too. So they had,
like most places.
Yeah, like most places. They lived a better life there and came here, you know, for other opportunities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I didn't grow up in the typical, stereotypical way when people think of black Americans. You know, uh-huh. we had swimming pools. My parents had good jobs. We traveled often. You know, we weren't rich by any means, but we definitely weren't poor. Mm-hmm. And there was no need for crime and all these other type of things like that. It was me going out into the world and feeling out of place, which kind of pushed me into the subcultures of urban America.
Right. The way I look at it is like when something happens to especially a kid, but even adults, they act out. You know, so if you're upset about something, if you feel ostracized from society, yeah, you act out.
Right.
So
right.
Just like a kid does if he's upset.
Exactly.
So you acted out in Los Angeles and did...
I acted out all my life. I was always kicked out of schools, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It wasn't, I'm sure it was for many reasons, but at the end of the day, I believe that it was because I was intelligent even as a youth. I was, you know, I grew up in a family of 8 kids. I was the youngest of 8. Mm-hmm. The rule for me was you are to be seen and not heard, because mm-hmm. everyone around you is older. So just shut up and pay attention so you can learn something. Mm-hmm. You know, don't talk.
Any brothers and sisters?
All, that's what I'm saying. I was the youngest of 8 brothers and sisters.
Okay.
You know, in one house. So right. For me, it was be quiet and watch. So I became an observer, and it made me intelligent. You know, I was like, I was the first spy of my house. I knew where everybody's everything was.
That's a lot of siblings, too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We were like the Black Brady Bunch, for real.
And all that moving forces you to learn to assimilate into all these different places. And
that was culture shock. Moving from Jersey to Atlanta was culture shock.
I'll bet.
You know? And all of this is the 80s, you know. So I'm in L.A. When we moved to L.A., that's the height of gang. That's when Colors was being made and all of that stuff you know. So all of that, though, you know, I had to learn fast, you know.
You got me real curious about what you did in Los Angeles now that made your parents move from L.A. to Miami.
All right. Well, so this kind of ties in. Like I said, I was always an observer. So this actually ties in now. So when we moved from Atlanta to Los Angeles, my parents kept the house and because it was a nice place, and they rented it out. Mm-hmm. So make a long story short, we went back for some reason after a year, and my parents made me come with them, something to do with insurance paperwork or whatever. My mother used to work for the airline, so we got tickets, free tickets all the time.
Nice.
So it was nothing for all of us to go fly. So we went back. So I'm looking around this old house that I used to live in, and it's decorated now. It's kind of pimped out. You know, it used to be me and my mom in there. Now this one guy lives in this whole house. And I can tell by the way it's decorated is that this guy smokes weed.
Uh-huh.
I was like, I just know this guy smokes weed. I can tell by the way it's decorated, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm 14.
The AIDS of mischief.
14 or, yeah, I'm 14. So, sorry, hold on, 14, 15. I'm 15 now. I'm 15, I'm 15, I'm 15. So I'm looking around the guy's house. Anyway, I get into the bed. The bedroom door is locked, but I knew how to pick the lock because I used to live in the house and I was bored, you know?
Right.
So I picked the lock and long story, I'm searching through this guy's room.
You're like, I'm going to pick this for old time's sake.
Yeah, basically. the reason why I knew how to pick the lock because my grandmother stayed in the house with us and she had Alzheimer's disease and she used to always lock the doors, bedroom doors, and they were, you know,
right.
And so I learned how to pick it.
Yeah. You know?
So that's why I knew how to pick the lock. Anyway, I'm searching through this guy's room. I start to find all kinds of guns, machine guns, Uzis, 38s, 9mm, bullets, all type of stuff. And so I said, well, this guy's either a federal agent or he's a drug dealer, you know, like I said, my father's Jamaican, and not to big up Jamaica, and not to put nothing on my people. But, you know, I said, Dad, where's the guy? He said, oh, he's in Jamaica on business. So I said, Jamaica on business, huh? Okay. Boom, I find the suitcase with the, you know, it just went bad from there. Anyway.
What was in the suitcase?
A bunch
of weed?
More than weed. Yeah,
okay. It was heavier drugs.
Heavier drugs than that. Yeah. Uh-huh. So I took a whole lot of stuff. You know, it was cocaine and there was all types of stuff in there. I'm sure the guy had jewelry, all types of stuff. But me being a dumb, ignorant, idiot 15-year-old.
But also really brave. I mean, I would have seen all those guns and been like, I am not stealing from this guy.
No. I was too dumb for that. I was too dumb. That didn't scare me. I was taking them and posing with them in the bathroom mirror.
Uh-huh.
I was taking these, and you know, doing the, oh, you talking to me?
Right.
You know? I mean, you know, I was an idiot. I look back to certain things and the way I saw the world and I can't believe.
Wait, did you take the whole briefcase?
I did not. I wasn't able to obviously bring the whole briefcase back to LA with me. However, what I did do was I sampled a little bit of everything because growing up in New Jersey back in that day was another thing. There was nothing to do but party and experiment with drugs. Mm-hmm. And I had so many older brothers and sisters that, you know, by the time I was 12, it was lit.
Yeah.
So, and then after I sampled some of the stuff, I immediately remembered some of my old friends' phone numbers from Atlanta. Now, if you read the book, you'll know that those guys weren't exactly the most law-abiding guys in the world.
Mm-hmm. So when you say you sampled stuff from the briefcase, you mean you took them with you?
No, I mean I did that, and then I tried them personally.
Right then on the spot.
Yeah, I just went into my old bedroom because my parents were doing some type of work with some insurance guy, you know, and they weren't paying. They didn't care where I was, whatever, you know.
You're the youngest of eight. They're like,
yeah, whatever. My brother got beat up, you know, got slapped up when he got caught smoking. By the time I got caught smoking, the eighth one, like, whatever.
I mean, you see that with even just like three kids by the third.
Trust
like,
me. I was coming home at, 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning at, in seventh grade, eighth grade. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter.
Yeah.
But anyway, I remember, back to the story, I remember these guys' phone number and I called them, and me being high and young and stupid, I told them everything. And they were like, oh, really? Well, what time do you got? When you guys leave? And I was like, oh, we leave tomorrow. Uh-huh. So boom, meanwhile, I get caught up in LA with the stuff. I basically get a confession damn near beat out of me. I tell my father, all right, I got it from our house in Atlanta.
Yeah.
He calls the house to tell the guy, like, listen, my son fucked up. I'll probably owe you some money when you get back. Let me know.
So you told your dad that you stole stuff from the house in Los Angeles?
Yeah, eventually. Yeah, because I got caught up with some stuff in Los Angeles, and I eventually had to tell. I tried to lie. Didn't work. I eventually had to tell where I got it from.
Yeah.
So he does the right thing and calls the guy, said, hey, my son fucked up, and I... Call me when you get back in town. I'll probably owe you some money.
Uh-huh.
While he's doing that, all of my friends from Atlanta were robbing the house.
Was the house in Los Angeles?
No, it's in Atlanta.
It's in Atlanta.
Because I did the drug, and then I called them, and I told them the whole story. Then we flew out and left. So I was like, yo, this house got drugs and guns and jewelry,
uh-huh.
and there's nobody in it. And they were like, oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Speaking too fast for you.
Went to the house.
And I don't do drugs now in my adult life, by uh-huh. the way. I just want to add that for clarity. Yeah. Further, future employers maybe.
Exactly. So they went to the house in Atlanta and robbed it?
Yeah, because it was my old house. They knew where I lived. They came and picked me up.
Right.
I was like, hey, come get me. They're like, who's this? I was like, yo, it's me from back in the day. They're like, okay.
Oh, no.
Came and got me, and we went out and partied because I had all this coke and weed and
so what did
they're like, where'd you get this? And I'm like, I got it from my house.
Right.
They're like, oh, really? So the guy comes home to his doors kicked in because they wasn't picking no locks.
Right. Oh, no.
Window broken, doors kicked in, everything's gone. All the guns, jewelry, anything of value, whatever money was in the house.
Right, because it's easier to rob from a drug dealer because it's harder for a drug dealer to report the robbery.
Well, yeah.
Because I'm sure all those guns weren't legal.
None of them. Yeah. The drugs weren't legal either. Yeah, but yeah, he's not going to report it. It was a culture at the time to rob houses for guns anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They'd rob a judge's house. They'd rob cops' houses, all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. That was just a culture. This is the 80s. There was Atlanta, LA. These places were really wild. In those days. So
the guy must have found out his house got robbed.
Well, he came home and everything was gone and kicked in and broken with my father on an ass machine saying, hey, my son messed up, I owe you some money.
And the guy's like, some money?
Yeah. So that's why we ended up having to move. And really, there's more I could say about that, but I actually, my angels are now telling me to kind of hold back a little bit. So there's some of that I probably even...
I mean, it's so long ago, I don't think you have to worry about it.
All right. Well, one of those, Well, it didn't end. He continued to look for his shit in Atlanta. And,
he was determined to hunt down your friends and find it.
Yeah, yeah. So all types of stuff was going on.
Did you have to give him names of people?
Oh, we moved.
You moved straight out of state?
Yeah. And, well, that's when we moved from L.A. to Miami.
From?
Los Angeles.
From Atlanta to Miami?
No, I know it's confusing.
Yeah.
It's...
Oh, you were living in L.A., but you went back to Atlanta.
We went back to Atlanta.
I gotcha. So then you moved from Atlanta. You moved from L.A. to Miami. But why couldn't you just stay in L.A.? Like, the guy was in Atlanta.
Yeah, but he knew exactly not only where we were, but the network. You know, it's a Jamaicans kind of all know each other.
Okay.
You know, the networks. Well, West Indians in general, the networks are easy to tap into.
Right.
You know.
So you're fleeing California to get away from a guy in Georgia.
Yeah. But somehow ends up in Miami. Yeah, right. Yeah. But there's reasons for that, too. Like, again, it's like family. You know, it's like a whole family. You know, there's levels and hierarchies.
Sure.
And all of those things
right.
involved with cultures. You know.
So did the guy ever get, did he ever make peace with everything that happened?
He went to prison.
He did?
Yeah, he went to prison.
Okay, well, that'll
And that was all I ever, you know, I'm not even really, that's another thing with West Indian culture. Like, I wasn't really allowed to bring up the subject mm-hmm. after that. So whatever else they found out, it became a no-touch subject.
Like, don't talk about
certain things you don't talk about. Let's just not even go there, you know.
Is that's a West Indian cultural thing, you think?
Yeah, I'm sure many other cultures. I'm Asian cultures as well. Certain family secrets that just don't get passed on.
Right.
You know, we just don't talk about that. You know, somebody, they'll rather exile someone from the family than to even go into the effect they had
right.
for whatever reason.
Right.
You know, so that became a taboo subject.
Were you scared for your life?
No.
Okay.
I was too young and stupid, but I did end up being sent to a rehab, basically just to get out of the house so my father wouldn't kill me. And I was the youngest one in the rehab, and I was in there with this is in LA before we left, mm-hmm. like when I came out, the boxes were packed, but I was in there with some pretty famous people, and it was a lot of fun. And even I had some little adult experiences in there too with some ladies.
Celebrity ladies in the rehab.
Yeah. And I was, you know, and I was pretty young, so that was interesting. That was a real LA experience before I got to, you know, I mean, yeah, that was a real LA experience before I left, you know.
Would you consider yourself as having a drug problem at the time? Or you?
No,
just,
not at all. Right. I was just stupid. I stole the drugs to sell them because I wanted to be cool and get a new nickname. Uh-huh. And, you know, and get girls.
Yeah.
I didn't want to do the drugs.
Right.
You know what I mean? I've always been an herbalist, you know.
Uh-huh.
Pills and all that other stuff, it doesn't. Like, I've been around everything, and I've had, especially when I was younger, and even being an artist, you have access to experiment with all type of things that are out there. But herb has always been my thing,
mm-hmm.
you know.
So having to move all these many times and going into new schools, how did you? Do you have any tools that you use to assimilate?
Yeah, yes. I became a professional at it. I knew I had to find my crowd, my circle of people in there. Every school had my circle of people. It was basically the opposite of the cheerleaders and jocks.
Right.
It was the kids who didn't go to class, the kids who had little, you know, who did, you know, the mischievous ones, you
right.
know. So it was kind of always, I had to find them in order, and then I'd click in, and these were the kids that partied like me and who did, you know, who weren't scared to, you know, drink or smoke weed or whatever.
You get good at figuring out
I
who
got
they
very
were.
Good at figuring out that. And I just learned that it doesn't really matter who you meet, you just meet one person and you work your way up, and eventually you find the bad kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
you were looking for the bad kids.
I was always looking for the bad kids. Yeah, you know. And what's funny is now I've worked a lot with in the school districts in Oakland and in Brooklyn,
uh-huh.
and I always say when I go in, send me the bad ones. Just if you put me in the class, if whatever bad kids you have that can't deal with, send them to me. I'll take them. You know, because
to hang out with. Or?
No. To deal with them in the school, in a professional setting, you
right.
know, teach, learn, teach setting. Because I remember, I've been to so many schools, and I was them, you know, and I remember so much of what it was like. I remember why I acted like that. I remember how fast I could size up an adult, whether or not they were genuine or not, or
uh-huh.
whether or not I like them or not, or right. whether or not, you know,
you could trust them.
Yeah, I could trust them. You know, it was so fast. I could tell so fast, you know,
yeah.
So I knew how they were sizing me up, and I knew what to say and how to, you know, and I still do. So I have a, you know, sort of a, you know, a thing for those type of students, you know, because I want to show them that you're not wrong. It's your spirit inside is just telling you something here isn't right. and you're rebelling against it, you know? And you're right to do that because a lot of this is bullshit. Right. And that's what I would tell them. And they didn't want me teaching history, and I'd hold up the history book and I'd say, you know what? You see this book? Most of it is bullshit. And I'd throw it across the room.
Uh-huh.
Now let's begin, you know, because... Yeah. So when they realized, okay, it's not necessarily me, it's they're trying to impose, like, I'm a diamond and they're trying to impose the shape of a square onto me, and I'm not a fucking square.
Right.
If they see me like a diamond and teach me like it, then I'll bloom, you know? So I tried to do that, you know, because to educate means to draw something out of someone.
Yeah.
That's what educate means, to draw. So it's like a sculptor who has a chunk of marble. And what does he do? He stares at the chunk of marble. He drinks his wine and smokes his weed or does whatever he does and stares at until what? Until the marble itself informs the artist of the form that's in it.
Mm-hmm.
The artist says, oh, now I see the form in this chunk of marble. And he draws that form out of it that's already inside it. He doesn't force it.
That's what you're doing to the kids.
That's what education is supposed to be doing to all kids.
Right.
But instead, we're turning them all into the same one, carving one shape out of all these different chunks of marbles.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not one shape. Mm-hmm. And we tell them, if you can't fit this one shape, then, you know, to hell with you. You don't fit into society. Go stand in the hallway.
Right. So I'm seeing that you've kind of come full circle. Now you got me curious. How did you go from kind of a criminally minded kid to the other side of things?
I was definitely criminally minded. I'm still criminally minded. Mm-hmm. But what people need to realize is criminally minded isn't necessarily negative, because great politicians are criminally minded. Businessmen are criminally minded. They just know how to focus it in a way that doesn't get them in trouble.
A more positive way.
I don't even want to call it positive or negative, because is a pharmaceutical company and the dude down the street selling ecstasy and weed.
Mm-hmm.
Is he negative and the pharmaceutical company is positive?
Right.
Because the system says so?
Right.
You know, so I don't know if it's positive or negative, so that's why I say in ways that won't get them in trouble, in ways that are accepted. They focus their criminal mindedness on ways that are accepted. You know, a con man, somebody like, you know, who could travel through India as a businessman or whatever, could also be a politician.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're con artists. You don't trust what politicians say.
Right.
They're like used car salesmen.
Right.
Right? So, you know, that they're criminally minded. A used car salesman might be criminally minded. The guy knocking on your door selling you, golf packages could be criminally minded, but he's not going to rob your house.
Right. I guess it depends on the intention. Intent.
Yeah, exactly.
Productive, destructive.
Productive or destructive. I think that's a good way. That's a beautiful way to put it. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Productive or destructive. And even then, it's like, it's sort of like smoking marijuana 10 years ago, smoking weed 10 years ago. Hey, I'm not hurting anyone but myself, quote unquote.
Right.
So according to law, according to common law, no victim, no crime. If there's no harm to person or property, then there is no crime. Why? Because I have a right to question my accuser. So you're giving me this ticket for running a stop sign in the middle of the night. Well, I want to question who I harmed.
Right.
You know, although we would all agree, stop at stop sign. So let's say smoking weed. You're giving me this ticket for smoking weed on the sidewalk at midnight with no one around.
You're not operating a vehicle.
There's no harm to person. There's no harm to property. Who called you? Who made the complaint? Who do I question? If I can't question anybody, you're according to common law, there is no crime.
You have to have grown it yourself and not bought it off the black market, because then you're supporting, you know, an illegal industry.
Oh, according to
if you want to get real technical,
according to them, yeah,
right,
yeah,
right.
According to them,
not
that's why I follow. I find myself very. I find my conscience very light in dealing with universal law. I don't watch man's law. Like, I'm watching universal law. Is this because you have to understand some things are legal, but they're unlawful.
Mm-hmm.
So. At the moment, for example, when this is being filmed, the big thing on the news is them taking children at the border from other. That's actually legal, obviously, for them to do.
And
But it's extremely unlawful when you think of the universal law and of nature.
Right.
A stranger shouldn't be snatching children from, you know, obviously. Right?
Yeah, separating families.
So now. I'm dealing with universal law, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't oppress anyone, you know, and I don't purposely harm anyone with my hands or my tongue or even my eyes.
Right.
You know, I try very hard not to, you know. I have, but I try hard not to, and I try to keep my... I try to make sure my good deeds greatly outweigh my bad deeds, even if they're thoughts. I try to make sure my good thoughts greatly outweigh my bad thoughts,
and, yeah.
et cetera. And that's how I govern myself.
So at some point you must have figured a lot of stuff out, because the 15-year-old...
Yeah, So I was sent to Catholic school very early. I was an altar boy, all of those things like that. You know, I was like one of the only black kids, you know, in class, that sort of thing. So I got kicked out of Catholic school in seventh grade. This is in Jersey before I began moving.
Did they send you there for religious purposes or
no? My parents sent me there. No, my parents sent me there because they didn't want us going to the public schools, because mm-hmm. they didn't want us to be like America. You know, in their minds, them being you know, new here, so called immigrants, you know, from Jamaica, they didn't want us mixing with so-called American blacks.
Oh, wow.
You know, because they're told that when they come to immigration, hey, you guys don't mix with them. You can't, you know. Right. So, and this is typical. Any West Indian family or even African family, you know, will know what I'm talking about. And this mm-hmm. And I don't ever see myself, we're all one people, obviously. Like, mm-hmm. I see that and I know that. But this is an older mentality that right. our parents had,
yeah.
you know. So they sent us to the private schools,
you
know, because they didn't want us, you know, and because they wanted us to get a better education, because then the public schools were for shit.
Right.
So, I was schooled by nuns and, you know, and things like that.
With all the religion that went with it.
Yeah, we had religious class every day.
Yeah.
And I loved it.
You did?
I loved it because it was like, I mean, it was like comic book type stories, you know what I mean?
Like, you liked the mythology.
Yeah, the mythology, and it fed my imagination, you know, right. wars in heaven and, you know, angels with swords and all this stuff like that. You
did
know?
You believe it at the time?
I did until I remember, and this is also covered in the book, but this is, I remembered until I raised my hand and I asked Sister Theon. Sister Theon said, and this is about fifth grade, so mm-hmm. Sister Theon said, anyone who's not baptized doesn't get to go to heaven. And I sat there and I thought about it and I raised my hand. And I said,
remember this from the book.
Yeah, what if you're a baby? Yeah. You know, and you don't. She said, well, that baby will go to heaven.
But not meet God.
It will never have, never get to meet God. And she said it so, like so knowingly, like this is a fact.
Right.
And from that moment, I was like, oh, this is some bullshit. That can't, like, even at a young age, I was like, that can't be true.
Yeah, well, know? It's an innocent baby.
It's an innocent baby. Like, yeah. That can't be true, you know.
They got to rewrite that a little bit.
Yeah. But what happened was that planted a lot of seeds in my head for the esoteric and the occult. Because I found that I couldn't find things that I was magnetically attracted to in your surface religious texts, but when I dug a little deeper into esoteric texts and even occult works, I found a whole universe mm-hmm. of information and knowledge, and most of that was because I had met, there was a catalyst for me within that, was I met an individual in San Jose when I first moved to California named Leon, and Leon was he was a master teacher of that time. and he was just somebody who had read and memorized so much information. For him, I think, you know, when looking back, he had so much information, I think he didn't know how to use it, how to apply it.
Uh-huh.
So you can become a slave of your own thinking. Maybe not a slave, but you can become hindered of your own thinking if you go too deeply into the conspiracies and other workings of the unseen and things that we don't talk about that are going on in this society.
Yeah.
if you don't know how to monetize it or use it, or to, because then everything you see, you're seeing all the symbols everywhere and you're looking at the, you become like the Terminator guy and you're
right, trying to make sense of all of it.
And now you've taken yourself out of the conversations, and right. now you've isolated
you've
yourself completely.
Far.
Yeah. And you can't get out. Me, luckily, I was able to take all this information and put it in my work.
Right, put it in your poetry.
In my poetry and in my songs, yeah. you know. So it's not just bumbling around in my head all the time, and I can actually take it and put it to use and even monetize it in that way, mm-hmm. to as where it's not all for nothing. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not just some guy walking around pointing at stuff, talking about the Bilderbergs and the Illuminati, and the which all of it is real,
yeah.
but... what does that have to do? Two things. What does that have to do with you paying rent and eating good, you know, a vegan meal tonight?
Right, right.
And secondly, okay, this is the main thing I realized, you know, which I'd like to share to anybody who is caught up in all this stuff, is that yes, it's real for the most part, but that's what these people do with their reality. That's what they choose to do with their reality. What about you? What do you choose to do with your reality? Okay, magic is real. Okay, chanting up beings or whatever is real. That's what they did. Great. What are you doing?
What are you going to do with that?
Where's your magic?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Where, aren't you a shaman too? Own that and do that. Don't study them no more. You learn, okay, yep, they're out there. It happened, 9/11. Blah, 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 blah. Yes.
Yeah.
That's that reality.
Did you finding a creative outlet help you get away from
that is when I completely stopped getting in trouble,
mm-hmm.
the minute I discovered that I could write, mm-hmm. that I found my passion, my labor of love,
mm-hmm.
and for that I'll be eternally blessed. I would definitely not be sitting here before you at all, especially in the capacity that I am today, if I did not discover my own labor of love, which just happened to be creative writing.
Right.
You know?
I love these stories because a lot of times it's like just one person that happened to cross someone's path at that moment that's made a suggestion, or you encountered yeah. one thing. How did you go from being a mischievous kid to finding your passion of creative writing? Do you remember how that happened for you? Did someone introduce you to it?
Well, I do. It's interesting. Again, this is all covered in the book, but I'll share this, and this is by no means a poor me moment. You know, mm-hmm. I'm very, very thankful for everything in my childhood. All right, mm-hmm. so all right, I was a bad kid. I was very mischievous. You know, yeah. I used my intelligence for mischief, but I was also dumb to the world, so I got caught a lot. Mm-hmm. My father was old school, Caribbean, old school. You know. They don't play, like, you know, so he put hands on, you know what I mean? Like when he disciplined me, he did it in a very strong way, you know, but it was never
like spanking or punching.
It wasn't a spanking. Yeah. More like slap, punch, slap, throw.
Not in the face.
Picked
though.
Up, no, face anywhere.
Really?
I was. Yeah. 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 It was real, real, you know, thrown into the wall, holes in the wall with your body, all type of stuff like that. But, again, it wasn't for no reason. And even later on in life, he admitted, hey, you know, I probably did go a little too far when you were younger, you know, but...
Having eight kids will do that.
yeah, having eight kids will do that. And again, to his... According to his culture, this is what he knew.
Right.
This is how he knew, you know, like if your son is out of line, you beat him in the line, you know? That's just what they knew, yeah. you know? So anyway, the long story short, like...
You're really nice about letting him off the hook, I gotta say.
I'm not letting him off the hook. No, I'm not letting him off the hook. It's not a. I won't say that I was I was a very dumb kid, it didn't work, but I understand where he. Again, it's all intent.
Yeah.
His intent was I gotta fix my son.
Right.
That's how he. That's what he thought was the way.
Right.
You know. But anyway, I was told, hey, your father doesn't like it when you cry when he hits you, like, because he wants you to be tough. He wants you to be a man,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, okay. So the times after it happened, I wouldn't cry. I would just take it, you know, and hold it all in and, you know, to make him proud, you know. And what that did, and what that did was, I learned how to find my off button, and I could kind of like leave my body while the event is happening. I could just shut off.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But what that did was, anytime I would get into an emotional situation, a fight or an argument, a lover's spat, you know, as a kid or whatever, any type of, I would shut off.
Right.
So if we'd get into, like, you know, kids fight. So we'd get into a fighting situation, the guy could be yelling in my face. He'd have to hit me or grab me or something to wake me up. Like, yeah. Otherwise I'm just shut off dead. And so it affected my expression. Like, I wasn't able to express myself when I was angry or when I was, you know, nerve or whatever, because I would be shut. It would shut me off, and then people go, "What are you doing? What's wrong? What's going on?" And I'd be like, and then I get frustrated and start cussing and going to get violent. You know, it was really bad. And so, long story short, I discovered one day that if I write it down, how I feel, if I just write it down, then it comes out.
Yeah,
and it comes out easy.
Yeah,
And
it feels good.
It changed I became Letterman. I wrote letters to my friends, letters to my mother, letters to my teachers, mm-hmm. to explain, hey, this is why, this dear math teacher, you know, this is da, 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 da. And I just started doing that, and I basically, yeah, it really just never stopped. And then it was just started doing it with rapping, just joking around, like in math class. Hey, let's make a rap about each other, and we'd rap battle each other, right. Just joking, never taking it seriously, never once thinking I'm going to continue to do this for, you know, years and years and years, and travel the world with it. You know?
You ever write any letters to your dad?
No,
never. None of those letters went to him.
No.
Mm-hmm. No. You ever write any and not send them?
No.
That might be an interesting letter to write.
Yeah, no, I don't need, I mean, well, maybe everybody needs a little bit of psychology work and things like that, but I don't really, that's a pebble. I've got some bigger rocks.
Yeah.
It's not the fact that my dad was rough with me. And to be honest with you, you know, today, masculinity seems to be really almost looked at as negative sometimes in certain situations and circles. So I feel like a dinosaur, but I'm proud to be that, you know. Mm-hmm. And I come from a certain era, you know. And sure, it's bad to tell your kid, boys don't cry, but, you know, men don't cry. You know, I wouldn't tell my son that now. Mm. Nah, man, cry if that's how you feel and let it out. Because I wouldn't want to stop him up the way I was stopped up.
Do you have a son?
Nah, I have a daughter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I have a daughter. but I was told that, and I'm from that era, and I don't make apologies for it. And I can still maneuver through the world because I don't have a judgmental. I'm that without the judgmental, like, oh, you eat tofu, or oh, you're gay, or oh, you went, you know, like, I don't have all of that, because I've lived in so many places, and I've been so many different people myself, and I've seen so much of the world, that I know that variety is the spice of life, and, mm-hmm. you know, it, you know, again, back to what you, intention is mm-hmm. everything, you know, it's just, are you being your real self? That's all I care about.
Yeah.
You know?
So once you found this creative writing, and it just started, I imagine it started to flow out of you. And you're feeling this feeling like you probably never felt before.
Yeah, I literally stopped getting in trouble, and I was and it was the writing and reading. Like, I started with the autobiography. I never graduated from even grade school. All those years of moving, mm-hmm. moving from New Jersey to Atlanta to Los Angeles to Miami to, that's all high school. That's all like mid high school. So. Uh-huh. I got kicked out of Catholic school in seventh grade. So I never graduated from eighth grade because we moved. They were like, were you in sudden? I was like, yeah, I graduated. Okay, now you're in ninth grade, you know, or whatever. And every year it would happen. Did you graduate ninth grade when you were in the other? Yeah. Okay, now you're in 10th grade.
Yeah.
You
know? They just put you in the age appropriate grade.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Did you
technically finish high school?
No, I never finished grammar school. I never finished high school. I never graduated from anything.
Okay.
So I am, and that used to embarrass me. However, now I'm proud to say that because I am self-educated. And I feel blessed because I believe it enables me to still be a free thinker. mm-hmm. in ways that a lot of so-called educated people aren't, that it's harder for them to think freely or to critically think about situations now.
And you got plenty of other education. I mean, you slept with an older celebrity in a L.A. rehab.
yeah.
That must have been a learning experience.
Yeah, exactly.
So what led you from creative writing to, I imagine it went from creative writing to poetry to hip-hop?
Yeah.
So the creative writing, what is that? Just like free-flowing essay sort of journal stuff? And then it went to poetry?
You read some of the novels, some mm-hmm. of Misfit King, and even you mentioned the flow of the narrative, or the voice of it. Some people call it the voice, I don't know, but to me it's just the flow of it. It's something that comes naturally based on, you know, over 20 years of training myself in one of the most competitive fields of creative writing, which is hip hop. Mm-hmm. The slang is constantly changing. You throw a rock, you hit a rapper. Mm-hmm. So in order to carve your name out in hip hop, you have to be nice with a pen or real lucky, you know? Yeah. So I apply that sharpness to any form of writing. I don't separate them. A poem is a song, a story is a song. You know, I have a movie, Postera. It's on Vimeo. Postera. Postera.
What's the movie about?
The movie is. It's my life story,
uh-huh.
but myself and my film partner, Zach Cederholm from Cederholm Films, we decided we didn't want to just do a film about Azeem or Azeem sitting, you know, on a porch in Bed-Stuy rapping or standing in front of some graffiti, right? Like, right. Gee, never saw that before, right? So we were like, all right, well, let's do this kind of documentary based on my life because I have all this old footage mm-hmm. of Bay Area footage and performance and interviews and all these things that we can incorporate. But let's throw a thread of fiction in it. Let's throw a thread of fiction in there, but to glue it all together, you know? And so Postera originally was going to be an art form that we were going to combine poetry and reality with a thread of fiction, and then you had to figure out which part was the fiction, you mm-hmm. know? So that's what the film is. It's 17 minutes long.
Cool.
It's won a few awards. It's been on multiple screens or international film festivals, et cetera. So the film is based on my life story, which was first done in as Rude, which was a one-man show that I wrote. Mm-hmm. Rude was my life story and my cousin Tommy, God bless the dead, who was one of the original, what we call Badman, like original gunman, gangster, kind of rude boy from Kingston, come to America in the 70s. He had dreadlocks in Harlem in the 70s. He had mm-hmm. to wear Afro wig to get jobs and stuff. So anyway, so it's my life and his life intertwined into one character.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody actually put that up on YouTube. That's called Rude. So again, so first I did the play, and then the play became the film, and then from the film, and the whole while I had actually been working on the novel. The novel is the real true story. Mm-hmm. The film and the play are have more fiction, and they're based on the real story.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, I've been kind of telling the same story over and over again in different mediums.
Yeah.
But their story's worth telling, you know.
And the hip hop, I mean, writing is one thing, but then being able to put it to verbal usage.
Well, performance, live performance is my, that's one of my, that's one of the things I have in my arsenal.
Yeah.
You know, that's where my Jamaican culture and heritage comes out because I'm real athletic, you know, and I got a lot of energy when I get on stage, when the lights and the music, and I can't turn off.
Do you remember the first time you got on stage and performed your original writings?
I do. And I'm sure there's film footage of it somewhere. It was terribly embarrassing.
Uh-huh.
And I was, at the time, I was, let's see, you know, 17, 18, and I was doing a really, really bad Flavor Flav impersonation.
Because
I was a really big Public Enemy fan,
yeah.
And I loved Flavor Flav's character and live performance.
Before you found your own voice.
Before I found my own self, yeah. So the personality I was channeling while I was on the stage was Flavor Flav, but they were my own words, you know.
Did anyone call you out on that?
Yeah, I heard somebody yell something about Flavor Flav from the audience. But somebody also actually approached us, like, hey, we want to talk to you about a record deal. But it was like cheesy. It was like, but I'll be out, but I'm leaving in a day, so contact me before. It was some old, you know, early 90s, like just whatever type of stuff. Then we won a contest, Marcus Garvey contest, and I won $1,000 and for a rap that I wrote. And that was definitely a good sign, because it was against a whole lot of other rap, you know, groups.
And I just started.
So on the West Coast, I only had one song, which was this song.
Was it recorded?
And it wasn't even recorded because I didn't have a place to record it. So we just made it and did it live. And the funny thing was, I went to Chris Peanut Butter Wolf, the owner of Stone's Throw. This was before there was a Stone's Throw or anything like that. And I went to him. A friend of mine told me about him. I called him and said, hey, man, I'm doing this thing. Can you make this beat for me? And he said, yeah, come over. I went to his house, went up into his room, gave him the records to sample myself. And when I won the contest, I won $1,000. I never bothered to call him and offer him any money like an idiot.
Yeah.
And he turned out to be the owner of Stone's Throw Records. And now every time I call him, he don't answer my phone calls. Nah, I never called him, but yeah.
Uh-huh.
I seen him in Vegas once or twice. And he was like, nah, I don't remember. I wouldn't either.
Right. It would have been a great time to start a really good relationship.
Exactly. And that's a lesson, you know, that I've learned a lot of lessons, because as an artist, you know, again, I'm the Misfit King. That's the title of the book. I've always felt like I was on the outside looking in, because no city I lived in, I wasn't from any of those cities. When I lived in the South, I wasn't from the South. When I lived in L.A., I wasn't from L.A. When I lived in Oakland, I wasn't from Oakland. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I've always been on the outside looking in, and I lost the thought.
Mm-hmm. That's all right. Yeah. So you... Stone's Throw, you blew that.
That's the lesson that I learned.
Treat everyone right coming up.
Yeah, no, look, like, if you have a circle, stick with it. And if not, like, try to create one, or even, try to create one by really bigging up the other artists who are around you. They're not your competition. Mm. See, when I was coming into the game, especially hip-hop being so competitive, I saw everybody around me as competition.
Even if
you were my friend, if we were getting on the same track, I'm looking to murder you on that track. And that's not don't see it as competition. See it as there's enough creativity and enough space for everybody. And if you have that positive outlook, you'll be able to congratulate your peers genuinely, with wanting nothing in return, and you won't seem like a threat or somebody who's gunning for them or somebody who's talking out of the side of your neck about them, and they will include you. Because I've seen a lot of underground rappers from my era, all of whom know me, all of whom I've performed with and been in the studio with, and they do a lot of things together, and I'm not involved in that, but they know. We all know, let's just say we all know each other, you know, and we all know each other.
Well, it must have been tricky growing up moving around so much, because once you find a clique or a crew,
you got to leave. Yeah. That's another thing. Relationships kind of, you know, you always have to leave your girlfriend or the girl you have a crush on or whatever the case may be, you know. I was a late bloomer when it came to all of that, but I always had some type of, you know, little kid, childish, little romantic thing, you know, and having to do that with friends and someone you think you're in love with, et cetera, et cetera. It kind of puts a little callus, you know, there, which again, it can be a blessing or a curse. You know, it all depends on, you know, there've been times that it's messed up things. There was times that it saved me.
Yeah.
You know, so but it all made me who I was or who I am. Now, today in my life, my whole purpose is just to make my daughter and my wife, or future wife, soon to be wife, is to keep them happy and make them, you know, keep them proud of me, and to not slip below the personality or the actions that they see me. Like, they see me on such a high, you know, they rate me on such a, I don't want to let them down. So that's what keeps me from doing a lot of dumb things, because I know there are people who see me as a certain thing, and I don't want to not you know, be a superhero to them.
Yeah.
You know, I want to remain that. Yeah. You know.
And having a daughter, I mean, that's like
your
chance to pay it forward.
Yeah, well, I got lucky with my daughter. Uh-huh. You know, I'm not worried about her. She's actually become my teacher now. Well,
uh-huh.
Not fully. I still teach her, but now it's a teach, learn, learn, teach relationship.
How old is she now?
Like 10 or 18, something like that. I don't really know. But
but I'm a great dad.
Yeah, but I'm a great dad. I'm talking to her and stuff. Nah. She's 19 now.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh, okay.
19. So she's running around Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's real smart. She's a world traveler herself. Mm-hmm. And
performer.
And now a performer, even though I tried my hardest to talk her out of it most of her life. But she's a little me. She's a Me 2.0. And I'm proud of her though.
Yeah.
She hasn't made the same mistakes that I've made, or at least she's been real smart, a lot smarter about it than I was. You know,
you've got six records out.
Yeah, six records.
And you've toured quite a bit.
Oh yeah,
I've toured.
I've had to have extra pages put in my passport and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, at one time. Yeah,
always performing. Traveling
and performing ever since I was a kid. You know, it's just something that's in my markup, my spiritual makeup. You know, it's like this particular class that I'm taking, this body that I'm driving right now, in this time, you know, particular time frame. I feel like I had a few things. I came with a like almost like ingredients or like a mock-up. Okay, I'm going to travel. I remember being in fifth grade and getting up to sharpen my pencil or something like that in class, right?
Yeah.
And walking back to my seat and a very clear voice coming to me saying, "You're not going to need this."
Mm-hmm.
None of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I stopped. I was like, "Huh? Did I say that to me?"
Yeah.
And I looked around the classroom and the teacher was writing on the chalkboard and everybody's looking in their books. And it was just the voice that, "Don't worry. Like, you're not all the school shit that they're teaching, don't even worry about it. You're not going to use it.
Mm-hmm.
You have another window you're going to go through, or another door you're going to, a different path
right.
than what this is trying to push you towards, you know." Mm-hmm. And I always remember that. I remember it clear as day, you know. And so I feel like, yeah, maybe I'm like what you call an old soul, you know, and that this incarnation, some things I've got easier. Certain things I have people consider to be real lucky, you know. People mm-hmm. say I'm lucky, but yeah, I just think maybe I put in some of the hard classes already.
Yeah,
you know, yeah.
But you're still young. I mean, you've got a ways to go.
Yeah, well, being young, you know, it's all how you think and what you eat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know nobody named Jim. I don't know Jim. I don't go to the gym. You go to the gym? I don't know nobody named Jim. When you look in Jamaica or Africa or somewhere and you see the people in the bush and how fit and healthy they are and, you know, strong, they don't know nobody named Jim either.
Uh-huh.
They just live.
Yeah.
You know, it's the way you live. Like, I don't take the elevator or the escalator. I take the stairs.
Yeah.
So I get my workout out of my day. You know what I mean?
You think there'll be a sequel to The Misfit King?
Oh, there has to be because I'm living part two right now.
You got more pages to write?
I'm you know, the character never went anywhere. I'm still here.
Yeah.
You know, I'm still living artistically.
So what's next for you? Do you know what's next for you besides finishing up the book?
Nah. Nope. Mm-hmm. Sure don't.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about leaving the country only because I've lived everywhere here now, you know, mm-hmm. and so you know, on some Frank Sinatra, I did it my way sort of thing. Like, I feel like I might as well continue to do things outside of the box. So
where would you want to go?
I'm probably going somewhere in Southeast Asia for now. I'm not mm-hmm. going to Europe, like Paris and Amsterdam and all that's fun, and actually as an artist, as a writer, I might maybe going there might be, you know, might work. But I'm thinking Southeast Asia because I love the food, because, you know, things are inexpensive.
Mm-hmm.
And over there, I'm not trouble. I'm not a possible robber. I don't have to deal with micro or macro racism. Da, 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 da. I'm just an American.
Yeah.
You know,
we're rock stars when we travel.
Yeah,
a lot of times.
Yeah. I'm just an American, you know, and that feels good. Not having that stress for a minute actually feels good, because you know, living in the South and all these different places and going to private schools, and I've lived in all different kinds of worlds, you know, and I know what the temperature is here in the country, and I see the things that are changing. I think I just want to go somewhere where things have kind of, where time stands still a little bit more, and everything's not always putting on a different costume and a different title and a different, we're too triggered out here. We're too media triggered.
You feel like all this external stuff happening these days, the external stimulation kind of inhibits you from getting in touch with yourself?
It could, because what happens is it's dictating, we're letting corporate media dictate to us dictate morals of
and our thoughts
and more of things about sexuality, relationships, family, politics, you know, religions, you know, all these things, and we don't even realize it because we've ceased to have a guard in front of our subconscious. Our subconscious, you know, the parts of our mind are wide open, and it wasn't always like that. People used to guard themselves from certain information, but because of technology and video screens and everywhere you look, it's like boop, 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 this, that, and subliminal messaging and all these things. So many things get fly through into our subconscious, and it builds up residue over years and years and years and years and years. So you think these thoughts are your own, but they're not. They've been placed there, but they've been there so long, mulling around. They've become yours, but they're yours without the work, without the research, without the life experience.
Yeah,
you know. So you're tricked, because it's like you're given the answer to the equation. You're being the beginning of the equation and then the answer, without doing any of the in between work that gives you the wisdom and the firm knowledge of what you're talking about. You know. So without the equation, how do you know that that's true? So you don't even know how to do the fucking equation.
So you just want
to... You can't give me the history of anything you're talking about.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. But you're so sure that it's true.
Right.
Nah, that's... Those thoughts have been given to us. We all suffer from it. And if you think you don't have it, or God forbid that you're too educated to do... Then you're really gone.
You think you can escape this in Southeast Asia?
No. I think that the form of it there is a lot more transparent for me, and a lot less hyper.
Right.
So, like, okay, for example,
less sensationalized.
Less sensationalized, and that, you know, and that I'll be able to be less affected by it because I'm coming from the belly of the beast of it.
Yeah, we're media savvy here.
Yeah. So over there, I won't be as, you know, it's just as strong over there for them. Because that's what they know, you know what I mean? The mind control, whatever you want to call it, is everywhere. Wherever Hollywood and McDonald's and Coca-Cola is, it's there, you know? But it's not as, you know, strong over there. So it won't affect me as much. I'll be able to see through it a lot more.
Yeah.
You know, I'll be able to see through it.
Another benefit of being an American.
Yeah, exactly. exactly.
So do you feel like ending this interview with some slam poetry?
I had a feeling you were going to say that, but I didn't really necessarily
a verse.
I didn't end it with a verse. Well, I'll end it on something that we're speaking on, since we're ending it on this subject. That'd Although I have a thousand of these to choose from, so I'm going to go with the second verse of a song called "Devils of Digital" that just dropped, I don't know, a couple months ago or something. So it says like this.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites.
So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Super subliminal criminal devils of digitals do more than tapping your phone. Flipping them triggers them colors, symbols, or messages hidden in frequency tones. Them winded opinions on wars and religions and politrickisms and views of the globe are lacking in wisdom, just media spending the fiction you think are the thoughts of your own. History books you rely upon, written by Babylon, made up of styrofoam bones. True hypnotism with intellivention were mentally programmed and privately owned. Putting up fences, rewarding pretentiousness, media made music breaking the code. This is for vengeance, they all in the flesh, while the true artist's essence exists in the soul. I'll leave it at that.
Nice, man. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Peace and love. This is Azeem, A-Z-E-E-M, thepoetazeem.com for now, but we're changing that soon. And yeah, look for my album. Latest release was Broken Puppets with Ancient Astronauts. And please look for The Misfit King coming soon. It's a novel, and you're going to love it. It's all these stories and dim sum. Yeah.
Thank you, man. Thank
One love.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.